The Bookshelf with Ryan Tuberty is brought to you by Eason, Ireland's favourite bookseller. Eason have a rich heritage of bookselling since 1886. In fact, it's probably where you got your first ever book, or maybe your last one, and hopefully your next one after you listen to this episode of our podcast. And stay listening for our Ryan Recommends slot, my weekly recommendation, where I'll discuss a book I've read recently that I think you'll really enjoy too. All the books we discuss on this episode of our podcast are available now in your local Eason store, or indeed order online from eason's.com before 6 p.m. for same-day dispatch with free delivery when you spend over a tenner. Eason, be inspired. Welcome once again to The Bookshelf with me, Ryan Tuberty, and a guest whose life story we'll turn the pages over through the prism of just three books we've asked them to pluck from their very own bookshelf. And they're not just any old tomes. We've got three books. One, the childhood book. Two, the book that made them cry. And three, the book that changed their life. And so to today's guest, a prolific storyteller who turned heads with her debut novel at the young age of 21, more of which anon. She went on to write 19 novels, selling a staggering 25 million copies. Good Lord, worldwide, her stories have been translated into over 30 languages. Two of her novels were adapted into major films within a single year, and they graced the silver screen with Hilary Swank, Gerard Butler, stepping in to bring her characters to life. But she's also a creative force in the world of television, creating the US ABC comedy Samantha Who, and her latest triumph, the highly acclaimed short story collection, Roar. So what a pleasure it is to welcome somebody who I consider nearly a friend, Cecilia Hearn.
Hello. Nearly a friend.
Well, I've been talking to you for 20 years.
I know. You are a friend.
Is that fair to say? I'm honoured. Yeah. Thank you.
Let's make it official.
All right. It's on the record now. Anyway, it's lovely to see you. Thanks for coming in to see us today. You're a very striking person because you are quite enigmatic, actually. And while I know you, I don't know you. No, but you know, you're like, you're full of devilment and yet you're shy and yet you're an introvert and yet you're not an introvert. I don't know. You know,
I can't figure me out either.
You can't figure out. You're still working on that.
Yeah. That's a lifelong journey.
it's a journey. So you're very enigmatic, which allows me then to bring it back to childhood. That's our first book. Before you mention the book that you've picked, I really want to get a handle on what was happening in your life books-wise as a kid from the age of, say, 3, 4, 5.
Oh, I loved books. I loved reading. And I always had, I was always reading, I think. But it's hard to say without getting into it. But I loved all the Ladybird books. Obviously, that's where everyone begins. But particularly like The Enormous Turnip and The Elves and the Shoemaker and all of those books that I think kind of trained me into how to tell a story. Like, they're just perfect little nutshell stories.
A little hardback.
Love
Ladybird
those little hardbacks.
With creepy illustrations.
Yeah, actually, they were very
weren't they creepy?
Yeah,
on reflection.
Yeah.
But they were so compelling to look at.
But perfect, like the perfect way to tell a story.
Yeah.
All those little nutshells. So I read, you know, I had a big collection of them and I think I just worked my way through them all the time.
Where did they come from, the books? I mean, did you pick them out or did they arrive or did somebody own them before you? I mean, can you remember that?
No, I don't remember that. I mean, I always remember them just being there, you know, and this is the terrible thing. Like, I know my mom read to me, but I don't remember being read to. Like, everything I remember about books is being on my own in a private, like in a little kind of hiding place in my own world. And I would remember the stories like I've lived them, you know, like they're my like memories as if I was on the adventure with the character.
Oh, gorgeous. Yeah.
So they're like, I really got into them, you know, really got into stories. I played a lot, you know, like had a big imagination.
Yes.
So I disappeared into my own world a lot.
Did the books bring you somewhere by way of escape?
Oh, I think so, yeah. I still do that now. I mean, I think that's the magic of books. They bring you somewhere else, but I don't necessarily think I was trying to escape anything in particular.
No, that's...
But I think that that's just what I loved.
Yeah.
I loved daydreaming. I loved making up stories in my head. And I loved the stories that were, you know, that I read.
Well, move it on then from those little books when you became more sentient as a human being and you had the power of choice. What were you drawn to?
Well, I loved reading The Famous Five, The Babysitter's Club, The Sweet Valley Twins, Sweet Valley High, like all of those books. And then it's not like now there's amazing books for young adults. It wasn't, I don't really think it was like that for us. But there was this weird kind of almost horror stories.
Yeah.
Do you remember these? Like there was like a whole, I can't find them now. But for many years, or a couple of years in my teens, I was reading these like crazy horror stories.
Who was writing these?
I can't remember.
But there was a particular
It was like
issue.
A genre of these kind of horror stories that I felt that's what filled my teen years. And definitely Marion Keyes. I remember reading Marion Keyes.
That's a big thing, your first Marion Keyes book.
And Watermelon was the first. And also Sheila Flanagan and there I go again, yeah, my that's lovely okay. memory.
What did these books bring to you by way of escape or enlightenment? Because you were being quite young reading those, and they were kind of growing up books in some ways.
Again, it was just like seeing how other people, like they were older than me, you know, older characters. So that was interesting. I kind of had an old head on young shoulders. So I just loved being spying into older people's lives.
Yes.
You know, relationships that I didn't have yet, you know, all that kind of thing. What was ahead of me?
Yes.
I loved that.
So it was like a manual.
And hopefully not. But just, you know, give you an insight into older people's lives. That's what I loved about it.
Let's go to your first book today then. Celia Hearn, your first...
Oh, sorry. Before we do that, I've just remembered what actually were my favourite teenage ones.
Oh, well, I'd love to hear them. You have plenty of time.
The Diary of Anne Frank was my absolute... And I read that over and over again.
Was that a school book or did you...
No.
Can you recall where that came from?
No, someone must have gave it to me. Yeah.
Tell me about... first of all, tell us the story, if you can remember, of Anne Frank. Just, I mean, most of the people listening to this will know what you're talking about, but she was a young girl in
Amsterdam.
Yeah,
young girl in during World War II.
Yeah.
Who had to hide away for 4 years with her family because she was Jewish. And she wrote a diary in hiding.
Yeah, in the attic.
In the attic. And it was just about her life, God, in those 4 years where she was... you know, hidden away from the world. And yet it was so horrific and also so normal because she was experiencing the same things that any teenage girl was going through. So I just loved it. But I used to, like, I wouldn't read it over and over again from start to finish, but I'd remember there were bits that I'd want to read and I'd jump back in and read paragraphs and just found it so horrible, actually.
Yeah.
But I think I identified with her and couldn't believe that this horrible thing had happened to somebody that was kind of my age.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Did it make you want to read more around the war or the Holocaust or anything like that?
Yeah, I did a lot of digging into that to understand it. I think I've told you before, I did read the Nuremberg trial transcript and went into that. I just found the whole thing so shocking and horrible.
Did you read the Nuremberg trials transcripts at that young age?
No, probably not.
Later. But it just triggered an interest in that whole world.
Yeah.
Because so people are fascinated by that period in history, obviously, for so many reasons.
I think it's so scary. I think when I'm scared of something, I want to know more about it, you know, and then just read it over and over and over again.
Yeah.
To like try and figure it out.
That's it. Because it's the brutal division of good and evil, isn't it?
Yeah, just when humans stop being humans, that scares me.
Yeah.
Yeah, or when humans reveal themselves. But when humanity is not what you think it is.
That's right. I was watching a documentary about Mariupol in the Ukraine, and the citizens are reacting differently to the destruction of this city. And somebody said in passing, this is war. Good people get better and bad people get worse.
Mm.
I thought it was a very stark thing to say. And you're kind of touching on that a bit with the Anne Frank story, or at least you're reading around it.
Yeah, I agree.
So your first book is a book from your childhood, whether you read it or it was read to you, or you just love this book. So what are you guys starting with? I'm dying to know.
So the first book is The Enchanted Wood by Enid Blyton.
Beautiful choice. Yeah. Okay. Tell us about it.
So I didn't have this book. I have like a soft, like a paperback here. Yeah. I think mine was like a bigger hardback and there were loads of illustrations in it. So I remember as I was reading it, I was like kind of, like looking at the pictures as well. You know, that was really important that I think that's why I remember it like I was in it.
Yeah.
Because this has less. So it's about these three children that move from the city to the country. Mm-hmm. And they find this enchanted wood behind their house. And the wood, like the green is a different color to normal green. And the trees are like whispering to each other. They're like, wish it, wish it, wish it, wish it. So they can hear them. They know there's something magical. But they discover this tree, which is so wide. There's rooms in it and there's windows on it. And as they climb up to the top, there's like a host of characters living inside. It reaches all the way up to the clouds. And there's a ladder at the top, which goes into a whole other world. And the land that's at the top of the tree changes all the time. So they could be in the land of topsy-turvy.
Yeah.
And they have to get out before it kind of circles around again and they can't get out. So
I love this. I love the sound of this. I've never read it.
I've never read it.
And I used to love the Secret Seven and stuff like that. But let's keep going. So
there's a series of them. I think there's four of these books, but The Enchanted Wood is the first one, and it's called The Magic Faraway Tree. So the tree is the Magic Faraway Tree.
It sounds so exciting. I imagine if you were maybe eight or nine, would that be right? Is that
probably? Yeah.
What an exciting escape route to another, literally another place in some ways.
It's so good because there's so many. like the journey up the tree is exciting because they're meeting loads of different characters. I'm trying to think, Mr. What's his name? A guy who can't remember his name.
Well, now here, I mean, this is beautiful.
And there's Saucepan Man who just, he's hard of hearing because the saucepans are clattering so much he can't hear people. So it's like they say something to him and he's like, whoa, and it's all a misunderstanding. And then there's Silky, who's a pixie or a fairy that kind of changed from book to book. And then there's someone, Wash-a-Lot, Dame Wash-a-Lot, who's always washing things and then pours water out of the window. So they keep getting soaked as they're walking up. So there's this...
like a computer game trying to get through all the levels.
And then there's Moonface. And Moonface lives at the top and his room has a slide that goes all the way down from his house, apartment, whatever it is, all the way down to the bottom of the tree. And then that's before you even get to the top. And then there's a whole different land at the top that keeps changing. And sometimes they're good lands, like the land of birthdays, which is amazing because it's just birthday games and birthday food all the time. And I remember when they were playing musical chairs, instead of someone removing a chair, you know, when the music stops, the chair gets up and walks away.
Oh, yes.
Like, I love that
detail, yes.
And then there's loads of, like, the land of do as you please, the land of take what you want. You know, like, for kids, that's just brilliant.
It's amazing.
But there's always a moral, you know, you can't always take what you want.
Yeah. So there's so much going on in that.
There's so much.
It's a busy tree.
It's a busy tree. But you know what? I obviously went back over it because it's been a long time since I've read it, just to remind myself. And it's not as epic as I thought it was, which is so interesting when you're younger, like reading it. I just pictured that they were in this land for ages. But, you know, they may be there for a little while and then they go back down the slide again. But I do think that was kind of my, apart from those Ladybird books, like my first introduction to fantasy, which I have, as I've explained, gone on to love. Like I love, probably don't love fantasy as much as I love absurd or surreal books. And they're the kind of things that I love reading now. Like authors like Andrew Kaufman, who wrote The Tiny Wife, or Amy Bender, who did The Peculiar Sadness of Lemon Cake. Like there are particular sadness of Lemon Cake. And like I love all those kind of quirky stories now, but I always see, oh, that's where I began. And that's what I'm still interested in now. And also what I like to write.
But how formative, you know.
Yeah. And even when I'm writing, I think, you know, my character is pretty much climbing up the tree to see what world she's in, you know, and that's the basis of all of my stories. Like,
really,
what land is it now for my character? So I think it began with this.
Do you have any thoughts on Enid Blyton, or do you care much about the author or her stories or her writing?
I don't know. Actually, know nothing about her personally, but I would say that her writing was important to me because it went from this to The Famous Five.
You moved on then? You went on the adventures to Cornwall or wherever the hell they were? Yeah.
Loved those stories. Yeah.
And they were so English. I mean, you're from a very Irish family. I am from a very Irish family. And, you know, and yet we rather enjoyed an adventure with The Famous Five and The Secret Seven.
Lashings of ginger beer.
You know, I mean, they were so quintessentially English in some way. Isn't it funny that we were drawn to those adventures?
Yeah.
Maybe there just wasn't an Irish version.
I don't know what the Irish was, you know.
Yeah.
You can't go on without mentioning, I Can't Go On, Under the Hawthorn Tree.
I had a feeling you were going to mention this.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Again, for people who've never heard of it, even though this book is an essential part of the Irish childhood reading experience. Bring us back to the famine.
Marita Conlon McKenna. Mm. And there's three in the series, but Under the Hawthorn Tree is the first. And it's about children during the famine trying to, their parents are gone. They have to find their parents and they have to make their way from one side of the country to the next, trying to survive during the Irish famine. And that was probably the first like serious book I read.
Yes.
Where I went, oh, everything's not about, you know, magical lands on the top of trees.
Yeah. Well, that's a bleak,
very bleak
contrast, isn't it? Because the famine, again, for international listeners, that's 1 million people died on this island.
Yeah.
And another 1 million plus left to go to Boston and Bristol and wherever it might have been. For all the wrong reasons, the most awful incident in Irish history, bar none. And for her to write a book on this for children is actually really important.
Really important.
So that story
stays
alive.
It's probably our first introduction, like that children have in Ireland, that, you know, not in the history books, and in such a human way.
Yeah, because the famine isn't taught very well in this country. I feel in terms of school, which I am a great time for history, as you know, and teachers, but I just feel the curriculum hasn't confronted the famine. But she did, Marita. Marita did really, really well. So I'm glad you included that.
Yeah, I think it's probably in every house in Ireland. So that was very important, that book. So I can't not mention that.
Give the Irish flag a bit of a wave there, and rightly so. Okay, so your first book being The Enchanted Wood by Enid Blyton. Lovely choice. Let's move on to book two. Cecilia Hearn, we're going to ask you about the book that made you cry now. And before you tell us what book you've chosen, Give us a sense of yourself as a crier. To cry or not to cry when reading, that is the question. Do you?
I don't cry very much, actually, generally. I'm not really a crier. But I do cry with movies and books. So I don't cry.
You do?
Yeah,
so,
I do.
So if you're confronted with real life conundrum or hurt or pain, it's unlikely you'll cry.
Yeah.
But on a screen or in between the covers of a good book, it'll take you to the crying place.
Absolutely, yeah.
What upsets you in these stories?
Oh.
Is there a theme? Is it, you know, I mean, for me, it's like if I see kids being hurt or in pain, that I find that's the one that might bring a tear to my eye.
I'm trying to think. It's usually like couples not getting together.
Yeah. Okay. Do you want to leave it there? No, I'm joking.
Oh, no. Or like somebody dying. Like usually.
No, stick with the couples thing for a second. No.
That's related. I mean, like something happening, like some.
Unrequited, is it?
No, like, or someone dying, or, you know, this great, like, love, and they didn't get together, or someone dies, or it's epic, and that's the kind of thing that upsets me in books. And I wouldn't call myself a romantic person at all.
No, I know you're laughing as you say that, so I believe you.
But I just, but I am in fiction. It's so funny. Because I love reading, here we go again, pause for the brain.
It'll come.
Jane Casey.
Yay. So she's a crime writer. Yeah.
But at the center of her crime, she's got these two incredible characters who it's like, will they, won't they, forever and ever and ever. And I love the crime. I obviously read it for crime. But they're the two that just like get me so hooked.
That's interesting. Robert Galbraith, who's, as you know, J.K. Rowling's pseudonym for her crime partner, the Strike novels. Have you read those?
No.
I think you'd really like them. If you like Jane Casey. But there's, again, two characters in that. And they're so well written. And there was a TV show called Moonlighting back in the day.
Oh, Bruce I remember Willis. That.
And it was all the flirting was going on. And will they or won't they? And you're so right. You the way people who love sport will on a team to win.
Yeah.
You know, people who love books and romance, if you like, are willing them on, going, oh, come on, you turn the page, going, get it together here.
I mean, the plot is amazing, you know, and the cleverness of the crime and the mystery. But oh, it's always the characters, especially if it's a series. You know, you're returning to what's going on with them next. Karen Slaughter does it as well in her, the Will Trent series, which I adore. Again, I'm reading these kind of brutal, violent books and it's like, but he held her hand. They're the bits that get me. Yeah, so that's what
I didn't know you're a crime writing fan.
Oh, it's probably my number one.
Really?
Yeah.
Why did I don't know. I knew we've never discussed it. We haven't. I knew you were, you liked surreal. You mentioned absurd, a brilliant word earlier on. I got that. But I didn't know you were into that.
Yeah, so Lee Child's Jack Reacher would be my favorite. Them, Karen Slaughter, Jane Casey. I love all those books.
You like them? Yeah. There's a writer from Canada called Louise Penny, and she's Hillary Clinton's favorite writer, and they wrote a book together, actually.
Yeah.
But she has the Inspector Gamache series, there's 20 of them. And he is this really elegant Canadian police inspector, and his relationship with his wife is so lovely. And so warm, and you just aspire to have that in your world.
Okay.
And it's not
you have to find that.
It's not uncomplicated in the sense that they have kids, grown up kids, but it's just such a beautiful study in a relationship. But just like that, that's got nothing to do with the story.
Yeah.
There's killing and stabbing and beating and all that stuff to keep the pages. But this is it's such a talent in a book.
Yeah.
To have that in a writer, to have that ability to, you described it a minute ago, to have this central story of a horrible crime, find out who did it, et cetera, et cetera. And then just this hum of romance or doom underneath. I mean, that's a skill.
Yeah, it is.
How do you do that?
How do I do that?
Yeah. How do you manage to have two plates spinning parallel?
Well, for me as writing, I think one feeds the other, you know, so I always come up with like a concept, the premise of the story first. Okay. And then I try to figure out who is in that situation. And then as soon as I create that character, then it like everything else grows from them. You know, it's they are the tree, Ryan.
Oh my God.
Never said that before.
The magic faraway tree.
They are the magic. Yeah.
But they are,
yeah, they are linked. Like you can't just have, you know, your idea. It's like, who is the person that you want to care about that's in this story? Because it's all well and good to have an idea, but it's not always a story until you have a character.
Okay. Who the reader needs to invest in and be invested in.
Yeah.
The book that made you cry, it is now time for you to introduce us to the book that you've brought in from your own bookshelf. And what I love about this, for people who can't see it, is not only it's a hardback, I love a hardback, but it's got a ribbon for a bookmark. I love a book with a ribbon.
It does. So this book that made me cry the most is called The Time Traveler's Wife by Audrey Niffenegger.
Modern classic.
It is a modern classic.
Yeah, tell us what it's about.
Have you read it?
Yes, I have.
Okay, good.
100 years ago.
So, yeah, 100 years
about
ago
20
too.
Years ago,
so
yeah.
It's about a woman named Claire who has a husband named Henry. And he has, I'm so happy I remember that.
Well, is that why you were smiling?
Yeah.
I was kind of going, you just gave yourself a medal.
I know.
Well done.
But he had this chronogenetic disorder, which meant, means, let's talk in present tense, means that he involuntarily jumps back and forth in time. So he's a time traveler. Mm. And what I love about the story is that it's really beautiful love story, which I love. But it's really dark.
Yes.
It's very artsy too, because the character is like a paper sculptor or something. Mm. What did she do? She does something with paper. And it's really, really smart. So, for example, the character meets Claire, is only like 6 years old, when she meets Henry, when he's in really hard to explain.
No, remember now, because it is such a bonkers concept.
It's so smartly written that like when you read it once, and I want to go back and read it again, because he's jumping forward and back in time. So he's meeting her at different times of her life. And when she meets him for the first time, she has known him all her life, and yet he hasn't met her yet.
Yeah.
And I just think that's so clever.
Yeah, I can see why you picked this. This is giving us an insight into the way you write, or the ideas you have in
so
terms
smart.
Of. Yeah, but I don't think you like linear.
No, I don't. No.
Is that be fair to say?
Yeah.
And this book would have been very, I'd say you fell in love with this book actually, and went, you get me.
It's the book, it made me cry. It's the book I also wish I wrote. You know, I just think it's so smart the way that she has done it. Like, so, you know, when she meets him, he's never met her. Because he doesn't meet her till he's older. So then when he's older and he meets her, he's known her.
Yes.
You know, like, it's so smart. Sorry, I don't need to explain this to you again.
No,
you get it.
No, but to the listener, definitely. No, I do. But just to keep up with it, you're going. But I think when you're reading it, it's been a long time since I read it, but when you're reading it, you find yourself in a groove.
Yeah.
So you can just roll with it, with the crazy.
Yeah, it is. I don't even think it's crazy. It just feels so natural. It's like it's like a natural thing that he's experiencing. And are we allowed to do spoilers? But why I actually cry?
I think it's once we say the word spoiler, it means if you don't want to know the end of this, turn off for a minute and come back to us in a minute. And how about that?
Okay.
Go, spoil away.
So he passes away. He dies when he's in his 40s.
He what? Oh, no, I'm joking.
Yeah.
Okay. He dies. Tell Motley we don't need our services anymore.
Scooby-Doo or Scrappy-Doo. And when she's an old woman, to explain, she's an old woman and she sees him in his 40s. It's the last time. So he has jumped forward in time and seen her as an old woman. So she hasn't seen him for like 40 years of her life, and she's an old woman sitting there, and suddenly there he is as a young man. And that just
blows your mind.
That's the bit that blows my mind and just broke me. I just thought that was so romantic. This, you know, old woman seeing her young husband who she hasn't seen for so long. And like so much happens in between. Like they try to have children, but because the babies have the same genetic disorder that he has, she can't. She has many miscarriages. So he has a vasectomy because he doesn't want her to suffer anymore.
Yeah.
But then a past version of him meets her when she's older, and they make a baby, and it works. And so it's just really smart. It's like different versions of each other, different parts of their life, meeting and having these conversations. It's beautiful.
Did you find it sad or romantic? I'm trying to figure out the tears. Was it?
It's sad and romantic and smart. I think it's just got the three things that I absolutely love. Like, it's really clever. It's beautifully written. It's dark, because a lot of romance is not. You know, it's just happy and
Of course.
But this one is like, I just love that it's got that. It's just so many layers.
You need
to
that.
It.
I think you need that. You need that sense of edge.
Yeah.
I don't think your happy clappy is in your bag. And it isn't. You just need the dark, because darkness is.
Yeah.
It's real. I mean, well, I suppose some people want happy clappy.
But with a bit of something uplifting though as well. Like it's not just dark all the way through. There's there's beautiful moments in.
No,
it
it's
well.
Not the road. Yeah. No, I mean, that was heavy. Did you ever meet the author, Audrey?
Never. And this version that I have here is a special edition. So I love it so much that I was going through a phase wherever I saw it in a different version, I would buy it. So this is like a limited edition. And this is, I mean, I can't see it.
We have a camera.
On the radio.
Yeah. Well, there's a little camera. Is this signed?
No, I don't think so.
We need to get it signed.
I've never met her.
So this looks like an American edition, because it's got that particular paper that you get in the Strand Bookshop
the
in New York.
The beveled edge.
Is that what it is?
Beveled, I think so.
Beveled edge.
Don't quote me on it.
No, it sounds like you're saying something like a spoonerism, like the deviled bedge.
I'm going to have to Google that now. I should have probably made that up.
No, it's good, but you said it with such confidence, I believed you straight away. So how many versions of this book do you think you might have?
I think I have four.
Okay.
Yeah.
The book that changed your life is your third and final choice today, Cecilia Hearn. And people will be intrigued to know where you're going to go with this. But before we get to the book that you've picked, it's a big one, isn't it? The life-changing book, because there's probably only three or two. Like this is one you could count on a hand.
Yeah, it's actually hard.
It's a really hard question. I regret coming up with it because, no, I think it's kind of a stupid question. But still.
No, because if someone has an answer, it's a good answer. So it's always worth asking.
Yeah, I think it's probably the hardest of the three books to pick. Sometimes they're not unrelated, the crying and the life-changing. But the life-changing one, if you can alight on it, ultimately, it is... It's a big deal. Do you find books can on occasion move you so much that you might alter your ways or your being or, you know, I mean, literally life changing?
Only from meeting people, I know that even a simple book like mine can help them at a time of their life when they go that or made me think a certain way. Or I remember with my second one, Where Rainbows End, it was about a couple that wouldn't get together for ages, best friends, and they finally admitted it. Sorry, spoiler. I was supposed to say that first, haven't I?
It's kind of spoiler first. Spoiler alert first. And then spoiler.
I forgot.
And then came back. So you just told the punchline and now you're telling the joke.
Sorry.
That's okay.
Anyway, no one will read it.
But, why the long face? A horse walks into a bar. You just did that.
Okay, the barman's. Sorry.
No, that's okay.
Anyway, I remember getting a letter from someone who said, I read that book and it made me tell my best friend that I'm in love with him. And at the time of writing, I am now pregnant and we're getting married.
That is life-changing.
So wow. I think if you've got an answer, that's an amazing answer. And it's not my book that did it. It was just whatever story she was reading that made her think about her life. So
it was completely your book that did it.
Well, thank you.
It was.
Yes.
I mean, if she had picked up War and Peace, she might have broken up
with it. Yeah. So that's an answer. But so when there's some that I've read that kind of affirm thoughts that I have and you go, yeah, that's important.
Yeah.
But I haven't really come across a life-changing book that I have read.
Yes, where you put it down and go, right, that's it. I'm moving to America. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Nothing silly
or
massive like that. So what book have you chosen? It's a book that changed your life and why?
I'm sorry, peoples, but it's a book that I've written.
Yes. Oh, this is, said the introvert.
It's P.S. I Love You.
Ah, oh, well done.
Yeah, it was my first novel.
That makes sense
it
now.
It completely changed my life.
Why?
Completely How? Changed my life. So I wrote this book when I was 21 years old.
Amazing.
And I had just finished college. I had a degree in journalism and media communications. And I was going to do a master's in film production. I was in for 3 days, got the idea for the book, started writing it at home at nighttime on my own. Obviously on my own. I don't know why you'd do it elsewhere. Yeah. But and was writing it for myself. And my mom was encouraging me and said, why don't you send it to someone? You know, it's time to look for a job anyway. I was...
Yeah, you're of an age, 21.
It was time to move on with my life. And so I sent it to an agent, Marianne Gunn O'Connor, who...
Legendary agent for writers.
Amazing. Yeah. And she agreed to represent me. And then she said, I'm going to send it out to publishers. It was only 10 chapters that she had.
Yeah.
And then within weeks, I had my first deal, a 2-book deal with HarperCollins in the UK. And then every day, and then I had an American deal, and I had a movie deal. Then every day after that was a new deal. And it was like the most overwhelming, amazing moment of my life. And I think it's actually 20 years this year since it was published.
Holy smokes.
So we have the 20-year anniversary, which is making me very nostalgic and looking back and at where I was then and where I am now. Yeah. And it was a phenomenon. It truly was. It was a phenomenon.
I love that your gentle confidence about it.
But I mean, it was because I'm not saying I'll ever, you know, it can't be replicated. You know, I can see it now. It was just an incredible thing that happened.
Yes.
So grateful for
it. And it brought a lot of joy to a lot of people who read this book. I mean, how many copies, I mean, blow the trumpet, how many copies has it sold?
It's like 6 million.
Holy smoke. Yeah, I mean, honest to goodness. I mean, you said something kind of almost throwaway and that you were 3 days in your course and you got the idea and you went home and you started writing. What was the kernel of the idea?
Do you know why I left the course though?
No.
Because I don't like public speaking. And I remember the first day, like on that second or third day, and they said, right, you all have to go home and, you know, watch a movie that you love. And when you come back in on Monday, you all have to talk about it. And I went, nope,
no,
not coming back in on Monday. Can't do it. I was just so afraid of so much. And it wasn't just the course. Like, there's obviously a lot going on in my own head.
Yeah.
And I just kind of created this. I was very fearful at the time. And I thought, and I needed the people that I loved around me so much.
Yes.
And I thought, God, what if I lose them? What if I lost anybody? And that just was so terrifying. I was thinking, well, thinking of all the ways that you could hold on to somebody.
Yeah.
And then it became not me, and it became a story. And it was like, well, if someone wrote letters, and, you know, I love handwriting. I think if someone writes something in their writing, then to me, it's kind of got a part of their soul, and I keep it and treasure it. So I thought, oh, well, what if someone loses someone she loves and she receives letters from him ongoing, you know, so it's kind of like communication beyond the veil in a way. Mm. And that's where it came from. So it had a lot to do with how I was feeling, but I put it on this other person and gave her a completely different journey and story. Like, I obviously didn't lose a husband and I wasn't grieving, but that's how I...
It's a version of yourself.
It was a version.
How you navigate. You're making this navigation thing with your hands. It's how you navigate.
So am I,
No, but it's lovely. It's,
that's how
there's that choppy waters and there's the boat and there you are making your way through them.
Yeah. So completely. And because I was in that phase of my life, not completely happy and all very confused and like, what am I going to do? And, you know, what is life about and who am I? And it's hard at 20, your early 20s, trying to figure out your life. And all of a sudden it was kind of answered. It was like, well, here's a career. You have to... write another novel and really travel the world. I was almost somewhere new almost every week. I look back and I kept my diaries.
Yes.
And it was so busy, just country after country, like finding myself in boardrooms, you know, talking about marketing and beveled edges and things like that.
You really are an expert on the beveled edge.
Yeah, it's not probably not even called that. But anyway.
No, but I'm going to make it a chapter of one of my short stories that I'm never going to write. The beveled edge.
Yeah.
He was
Sounds like a pub.
I would drink there. Tell me briefly about the abject fear of public speaking that you had, because there are a lot of people listening who will completely connect with that. It's such a hard thing to do, to stand up in front of people. It is a grotesque request for people. It really is.
If you have a fear of it, it's absolutely horrific.
If you have a fear of it. But you've just jumped from that and leaving a course and going home to your wardrobe with the carpet to write your book, to going to boardrooms around the world, pitching and selling public speaking to these suits. How did you navigate those waters to become somebody who's, you know, this 21, 2, 3-year-old going, gentlemen, my idea is as follows. You know, I mean,
and that's it.
How the hell did that happen?
It's so funny. I mean, they say you attract your fears, you know, and from a young age, I hated being asked to read in class. Like, hated
anything to be speaking out loud.
My heart would just... I would never put my hand up for anything. Mm. If it was a class where I'd have to read, I'd be gone to the toilet straight away. You know, I just tried to escape it so much. And obviously then the fear, you know, it just grew because I had like kind of a block on it. And the same in college, if it was one of those lectures where I knew we just had to sit there and read, I wouldn't go in. Like, it was really, really bad. And then all of a sudden, I remember, P.S. I love you, I got the deal. And I was like, well, this is amazing. I'm going to be able to sit in my house and just write.
I may never have to leave this room again.
I'll never have to leave my house, which is perfect. I'll never have to say anything out loud to anyone ever again. And the phone call was like, they want you on the Late Late to talk about the book deal.
Oh, God.
You're on Pat Kenny Radio on Friday, and then you're going on the Late Late. And I was just like, what? What? And it was the total opposite to what I thought it would be. And that is the thing about writing. It's two very separate worlds. One is where you're on your own, comfortable.
Your favorite bit.
Favorite.
Yeah.
And then there's the media side of it. And then there's the events, you know, author events and traveling around and doing, you know, book festivals and things like that, which is amazing because you get to meet readers and actually meet the people that are reading your book. And I think that's really important.
It's very healthy.
It is, And it helps. You know, it helps me on the days when I can't put one sentence together, you know, and it's like you've got the days where everything's so fluid and you're in the flow and it's like magic.
Yeah.
And then the days where it's like, I can't even write one sentence.
Sure.
And then I'll think of the people and I'll think of those audiences, and that does really help.
I still don't know how you got over it.
Because
you still have the shyness about you, although it's not remotely as bad as it was before, certainly 10 years ago. Was it a process that just came about? Or did you have to work on it?
Oh, I think the more you do it, you just have to do it.
So there
was
just
no
keep going.
Choice. There was no option.
Yeah.
I remember doing an event in Germany really early on, and I had such a fear of people like looking at me. It was so weird that they turned all the tables around. I was supposed to be on the stage facing out, and they're like, oh, and I got really upset. I was like, I don't think I can do this. So they turned the tables around, and I had my back to the audience. How mortifying is that?
No.
Like, it was a really big, really big fear.
I feel not sorry for you, because that's patronizing, but part of me would love to reach out and hug that version of you and say, look, it's okay, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's obviously, I think actually it's one of the number one fears that people have is public speaking.
The great irony, I suppose, is to say that, you know, your father was the Prime Minister, the Taoiseach, one of the most public speaking jobs in the world. And here's his daughter.
But I think I got so nervous for him. I think that was the thing. I think I remember being at every, you know, speech, not every speech that he did, but, you know, the big speeches, like the Minister for Finance.
Yeah,
thing, they had to drag out the kids for that. The budget speeches. And like he'd be eating honey before, like spoonfuls of honey just to help his throat. Like I just remember, and I remember just thinking, oh, the talking out loud. It was just such a fear.
You were eating the honey.
He was eating honey to help his throat.
Oh, because that was a long, it was a long afternoon.
Because it was to speak for like an hour and a half or 2 hours or something, whatever.
So were you getting asymmetrical fear of
public
speaking?
I think I took on. Yeah, and then, you know, when I'd be watching him at Ordesh's, I'd feel his, oh, I just get so nervous for him.
That's
so just anyone talking out loud, I feel for them. I'm like, why would you?
Does your sister have the same issue? Did she ever?
She's not as bad as me, but neither of us like, yeah.
Is your mum shy?
No, she wouldn't like public speaking. None of us do.
None of you like public speaking. That's the bottom line of it, isn't it?
but it's necessary.
P.S. I Love You is your own book, and it's the book that changed your life.
Okay.
They're sitting on this desk between us is what looks like, it's a refill pad, essentially, but there's looks like maybe three or four of them put together.
Yeah,
and
it's falling apart.
It's ruining the aesthetic of our studio.
It's very ugly, but beautiful things came of this ugly thing.
What is this beautiful ugly thing?
So this is the manuscript of P.S. I Love You. This is
the original. Draft?
This is my first draft.
Can I have...
Yeah, no, it's total cringe. But I have to tell you...
Don't be cringe, come on.
I put the time... Look, the 11th of October, 2002.
Wow.
My writing is so much better now, by the way.
You don't have to defend
I wrote it
yourself.
At 2 a.m. That's when I started, so that could tell you where my head was.
11th of October, 2 a.m., 2002. No, don't be afraid to fall in love.
I knew what number 10 was going to be. The 10th letter. I knew from
the beginning.
Holly
held a cotton sweater to her face. Redacted. The familiar smell immediately struck her.
But look,
with an overwhelming grief, which trotted her... which knotted her stomach and pulled at her heart. Now, you read the first one. Read it.
Holly held the blue cotton sweater to her face and the familiar smell immediately struck her, an overwhelming grief knotting her stomach and pulling at her heart.
Now, the only difference there is what? I'll tell you.
I'm too cringing again.
No, what colour is the sweater?
Blue. I didn't have blue.
No colour here.
You see, I learned to become more descriptive as time went on. I put colours in.
This is such an interesting process. Please don't ever...
Never get rid of that.
This is really important. Like, this is like a writer's museum will want this and will need this or whatever it is.
But I have to show you.
Look
really
at all handwritten.
So what I would do is I wrote longhand from like 10 at night or till 6 in the morning. Or 4 in the morning.
So how many of these pages would you have written in a night, would you say?
I would write a chapter. So a chapter per night.
Which is, what about 14
pages? 14 probably?
Yeah. Or 40?
14, I'd say.
1-4. Crikey.
And then, but at that stage, no, I would have been writing more. I was flying through it. So I was probably writing a couple of chapters at a time.
Did your handwriting change as you got more tired? There's something here. Like, suddenly it goes all... Like,
I think with the emotion as well.
And it goes, bah, 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 bah.
That's what it sounds like. It's the way the brain's going. Like, and if I was writing something where I was like racing to get to the end, it would probably get really, really messy. You know, if I was like, excited and I can't keep up with my pen.
Oh, I love that. So the flow is like a geezer.
But I have to show you something at the back because I actually show this to, if I'm doing like writing workshops.
You need to mind it a bit better. I don't like the way you're just jumping around the place with that now. No, honestly, your disrespect is
extraordinary. Sorry, having you have it in. I think you're the first person who's ever touched
it. To touch. Oh, sorry. I'm clean.
That's okay. At the very back, so when I got my book deal.
Yeah.
And the reason why I bring this up, because I've done a lot of events where there's people who want to write or want to be published, and I think they have their notebook and pen and they're trying to find out what is the thing that they need to know to become published. And I was, you can see from this, I knew very little, but all I knew was my story. And when I signed the contract, it said in it, word count between 80 or 100,000 words, or 100,000, 120, I can't remember what it was. And I had no concept of how big a book that was. Mm. So I went out and I bought a book and I counted the number of words on the first page, multiply that so I could get a concept. No, I didn't count every word. I did multiply.
It was very clever. Okay, go on.
Just to get an idea of what a 100,000 word book looked like.
Yes.
Because I didn't know. And I also, because I was so young, didn't want to ask. I didn't want them to think I didn't know what I was doing, you know. So at the back of this, I also didn't know about word count on a computer. Had no idea.
Yeah.
And I counted all my words and I have chapter one, word count, chapter two word counts, and I would add it all up so that I know I was hitting the contract breach.
Did you really?
Yeah, that's how.
And at the back is your mathematical equation,
count.
Is it?
Yeah, oh, which is me. Like.
So you've gone from nerd to geek.
To really very kind of innocent.
Oh,
I think.
Look at it.
Yeah.
Look.
I worked it out.
You really did.
Because I thought, well, what if I don't meet the requirements? Contracts are very scary, you know, they're scary things. And if I didn't do what they were, what they required, maybe they wouldn't publish the book. So
you're a very organized person. I mean,
yeah, I'm quite.
That is org. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
My head. So even though I have a very creative head, I'm very. I don't know what's the word.
There's a structure to it all.
Yeah, there's very structures. Yeah.
The final question. I've really enjoyed our chat today. Thank you. Our final question is to give us the name of the autobiography you haven't written yet. I can't imagine you would ever write an autobiography. I really don't. I think you're a very private person.
I
think you're a very dignified person. And I think you would find the idea of an autobiography kind of tawdry. Am I right or wrong?
No, you're right. But also because I don't really understand myself as much as I would my own characters. You know, like I find that people, even whenever I go to do an interview and someone, I've written about fiction and someone says, and ask me about me, but I'm like, I'm not here about me. I don't really question myself in the way that I would analyze characters in a story. So I kind of wouldn't remember half the things, as you could probably have witnessed.
Yeah, I'm getting a sense of that. Yeah.
But I don't really self-analyze.
Why not? You'd be terrified.
I don't know.
By what you might
find. I don't
know
why. It's funny, like younger people now seem to have to sum themselves up so quickly, like in 30s. I'm this and I'm that and I'm that, and they're so sure of who they are. And I don't really think it matters.
Just get on with it.
Just get on with it.
Yeah.
But I know that's a wrong attitude, by the way. And that's very kind of old Irish.
Yes.
Don't analyze me.
Yeah.
But that's just the way I am. So first of all, I don't think I could write it. I don't think I could remember anything.
It would be the worst autobiography ever written. I was born, I think.
Born in the middle of the afternoon. I would always be taking from someone else.
I'm married with three, four. I've got a few kids. I'd like the vagueness of your book.
But if I was to write it, it would have to be something. You know, there's some clever memoirs where they kind of theme it or something.
Yeah,
that'd be the only way.
Okay.
But I don't have a title, but I love this question because I do this for other people.
Yeah.
When we go out, I'm like, what's the name of your autobiography?
And you do? You play this?
Oh, I play this game.
Okay, talk to me then. So what have you come up with?
Oh, not, but I don't do it for me.
That's, get this woman out of
but
my
as
life.
We're here, okay, I thought about a couple of things. Like, if I asked my kids, they'd say, where's my phone? That's kind of the thing I say most in life. Like a couple of times, like every couple of minutes, I'd say, where's my phone? Where's my phone?
Oh, Lord.
Where's my phone?
What's your relationship with your phone like? Apart from losing it, I mean, is it your drug?
Yeah, it's with,
You're sounding like where's my phone? Where's my phone?
Well, life is in it, isn't it? Life is in the phone.
Yeah, it is. I hate that, but it's true.
Yeah, and also put notes in my phone. So it kind of, it's like my memory.
Okay, so you tap a note in.
Yeah,
okay,
so if I don't have my phone, I don't remember anything. But I write things down too, but anyway. Okay.
So where's my phone would be
the
children's vote.
Where's my phone is the children's vote. Then, like, I have a thing where I always say, Mommy never gives up, which is really annoying because I hate, like, if I start something, I have to get to the end of it. I'm very...
Psychotic.
Yeah, psychotic. Lego or a book, I have to. Once you begin something, you have to finish it. You
like
have to
the Millennium Falcon.
Yeah, which I don't have. I didn't do that one. I did Hogwarts.
Hogwarts.
Yeah. But yeah, so that's my thing.
I've
you
seen
begin
the
something, and I have an almost obsessive thing about me where as soon as I begin something, I have to finish it. If I begin a novel and I stop for the day, I feel like I've paused them in this world that I need to return to and continue it. So I kind of tried to move as quickly as I possible to.
So it's called Mummy Dearest. What?
So anyway,
Mummy
when my kids do something and they stop, if they give up halfway through, I'm like, Mummy never gives up. And but it's that kind of shrill tone now.
It sounds quite terrifying, actually.
Never gives up. Mummy don't give up. Mummy never gives up. And I try to for it to be like a positive, inspiring thing, but I
no,
think
it's
it
menacing
just sounds
and, like... and threatening, actually. It's like a psychotic Mary Poppins.
It is. Mummy never gives up.
Pick,
there's the two that wouldn't sell.
Okay.
But I think Imagine If is something that I've been saying ever since I was young with friends, you know, and I do to myself, Imagine If.
Yeah.
I've been saying Imagine If ever since I was a child. I live in my head. I daydream. I try to make those dreams come true, like in work. If I have an idea, I'm like, I don't care how scared I am. I'm going to go to whoever I can and share it. And I think that's Imagine If has made a lot of things happen in my life. So that would probably be.
Imagine if you wrote an autobiography. That would be the title. Imagine If. Would there be an ellipsis, a little dot, dot, dot after it? Or is
I think
it just.
So, yeah.
Yeah, it would have to be, wouldn't it? And a photo of yourself on the front?
No photos.
Big photo of Cecilia Hearn on the front. Just your back to the...
I think it's just...
Just your back to... like that German book conference. Just your back.
Oh, my God.
That'd be a great cover, actually.
I think
you shot from behind, just looking out at the sea or something. Imagine if...
Oh, my God. But I do think it sums up my mind and how my life has been. You know, imagine if this would happen. Imagine if that. And then you try to make it happen.
It's a great title. I'm just glad you remembered it. That's the most important part.
That's
what I'm taking back. Cecilia Hearn, you know, I always love talking to you. You know that.
Thank you.
We are friends. I mean, look, come on. This has been just an absolute joy. Your insight into your own world and the imagination is just, it's really enriched my world today. So thank you for being here.
Thank you, Ryan.
See you soon.
Thank you.
So here's this week's Ryan Recommends, brought to you by Eason, Ireland's favourite bookseller. It's called Glorious Exploits. It's by Ferdy Lennon, and it's quite mad. Imagine 412 BC, two lads wandering around Sicily. There's been a massive war and all the prisoners of war, the Athenians, are in these pits all around the place. Back to our two lads. They love theatre. So they decide, let's pick a Euripides play and stage it using these lads in the pits. Now here's the twist. The two fellas talk in pure Dublin. Right? So you can imagine Roddy Doyle meets ancient Greece. It shouldn't work. You think it couldn't work, and yet it completely works. It's like something I've never read before. So that's what I'm recommending. Glorious Exploits by Ferdy Lennon. Try it. See what you think. And it's not too long, so it's not going to kill you to get there, okay? Enjoy. And this book and all the books that we discuss on this episode of our podcast are available now in your local Eason store. Or indeed, you can order them online from Eason's.com before 6 p.m. for same day dispatch with free delivery when you spend over a tenner. Eason, be inspired.